Hello and welcome to Roots of Today, the podcast where the past meets the present. With every episode, we journey through time, uncovering the lessons, parallels, and connections between historical milestones and current events to create a deeper understanding of the compelling stories and issues that shape the news. This week, we're going to get into the weeds a little bit and take an in-depth view of the United States Senate, specifically how the body was originally structured in the Constitution, how the 17th Amendment changed the method senators were selected, and why that change was detrimental to our federal republic. Buckle up, because we're going to tackle history, civics, and political theory, and when we're done, you're going to know more than you did at the beginning. As always, this is Alan, your host, reminding you to grab your coffee, tea, or whatever beverage you prefer as we get underway. First, here is some backstory to the backstory. Every 4 years in November, eligible voters in the United States cast their vote for a candidate running to hold the office of president. Along with the vice president, it is the only office at the federal level that appears on every ballot in all 50 states. However, the people do not directly elect the president. The Electoral College does. If any candidate fails to secure a majority of the Electoral College votes, then the president is elected by the House of Representatives. This method for electing the president was born out of several concerns by the framers of the Constitution. Firstly, the framers wanted to prevent larger states from dominating the presidential election. The Electoral College gives each state a number of electors equal to its total number of senators and representatives, ensuring smaller states have a meaningful role. Secondly, many of the delegates at the Constitutional Convention were skeptical of giving the general public full control over presidential selection, fearing that voters might lack the necessary information to make informed decisions. The Electoral College was designed to place a buffer between the population and the selection of a president. No doubt, had they gazed into a crystal ball and taken a hard look at what passes as political discourse on social media today, they would have felt justified by this sentiment. Thirdly, delegates considered alternatives such as direct election, congressional selection, and election by state legislatures, but none gained broad support. The Electoral College emerged as a compromise. And finally, the provision for the House of Representatives to elect the president, if no candidate wins a majority of electoral votes, was created to handle closely contested elections. If the election falls to the House, each state delegation casts one vote, again protecting the influence of smaller states. The Constitutional Convention was, above all things, a political debate, and the Constitution that resulted from that debate contained a series of political compromises. One of those issues that forced compromise was the fight between the power of the larger states and the smaller ones. By the time we get to the end of this episode, it will be clear that that struggle continues to this day and is central to the current debate about the Senate. This sticking point was resolved by the creation of a bicameral legislature, with one body seated by representation based on population and the other based on equal representation of all states. The United States Senate was established as one of the two chambers of the U.S. Congress, alongside the House of Representatives. Its creation was a result of the Great Compromise, also known as the Connecticut Compromise, during the Constitutional Convention, and it resolved the contentious debate between large and small states about how representation should be allocated in the new national legislature. The two separate chambers also facilitated something that is all but ignored in today's debate over the Senate. The Congress, as designed in the original Constitution, represents two separate interests. The importance of this cannot be understated, or I should say, should not be understated, because it is all but ignored today. The Congress is supposed to represent two separate and distinct interests. Yes, two. The first is the people, which is the role of the House of Representatives. Because it represents the people, the seats in the chamber are allocated based population. On a side note, this is also where the original 3/5 language that considered slaves as less than a whole person comes in, as it was also a compromise over the power between free states and slave states, as counting slaves for the purpose of splitting up House seats was an issue for both sides. However, the other interests that needed to be represented in the national legislature were the individual state governments, or more specifically, the individual state legislatures. In this way, the states themselves had a measure of control over the power of the federal government. Since the state legislatures were being represented, the senators were to be selected by those legislatures. This was how U.S. senators were seated before the passage of the 17th Amendment in the early 20th century. The one thing that has been a constant part of this story thus far is this: power. All of these compromises were about power. Who had too much, who did not have enough, driven by a fear of tyranny, which was justified considering what the new nation had struggled with in the days before the Revolutionary War, and especially the hardships overcome during the long war that languished for 6 years. Yes, tyranny was the elephant in the room, and everyone knew that it flourished when too much power was concentrated in too few hands. Right about now, we need to take a detour and add some backstory to the backstory of the backstory. Don't worry. We'll get to how all this ties to the present at some point. I promise. The Founding Fathers were greatly influenced by the Enlightenment thinkers of their era. For example, the Declaration of Independence reflects John Locke's belief that civil government was formed to protect life, liberty, and property. Jefferson mirrors this with his famous passage, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." However, if the Declaration of Independence was the why regarding the question of American independence, the Constitution is the how in that equation. For inspiration, they turned to the writings of a French Enlightenment thinker named Montesquieu, whose most significant work, The Spirit of the Laws, provided an analytical framework for understanding the relationship between political institutions, law, and liberty. The framers of the United States Constitution were deeply inspired by Montesquieu's concepts, particularly the separation of powers, the concept of checks and balances, and the necessity of virtue in republican government. An honest look at the history of civilizations reveals an undeniable fact. The biggest problem with any system of government is the people in charge. Just as humans can display positive traits such as compassion, patience, and empathy, they also can display traits such as hate, cruelty, and compulsiveness. Benevolence and malevolence are two sides of the same coin. The genius of Montesquieu is his belief that the best way to stop tyrants is to keep them from having enough power to be tyrants. In The Spirit of Laws, he wrote, "When the legislative and executive powers are united in the same person or in the same body of magistrates, there can be no liberty. Again, there is no liberty if the judiciary power be not separated from the legislative and executive." So, to prevent tyranny, he argued, government power should be separated into co-equal branches, each with its own power and responsibilities, and each with the power to provide a check on the power of the others. Ultimately, the goal is to have a government incapable of trampling on the liberty of the people. Because the power is so divided and diluted, it becomes impossible for tyranny to flourish. Honestly, as simple as this concept seems, one has to wonder if a majority of the country really understands it. Every election season, we have politicians running for office who promise to streamline government, and voters and a media that demand the government be more efficient. But, and this is an important point, the government was designed by the founders to be inefficient. That inefficiency isn't a bug, it's a feature. Streamlined and efficient governments are easy to find throughout history. With a quick glance at the 20th century, one can find many. Hitler had one, Stalin had one, so did Lenin, Pol Pot, Mao, or any of the other dictators who had an iron grip on their countries. No need for messy debates, compromises, checks and balances, or judicial review. If any of those leaders wanted something done, it got done. So yes, it is possible to have a streamlined government. The only downside is you lose any semblance of liberty or civil rights. So now that all of that backstory is out of the way, let's get back to this week's topic, the U.S. Senate and the 17th Amendment. In the original wording of the Constitution, each state legislature selected the U.S. senators for their own states. Remember, Congress was supposed to represent both the will of the people with the House of Representatives and the will of the state governments with the U.S. Senate. The Constitution grants the Senate the authority to provide advice and consent on presidential appointments and treaties. Those appointments include federal judges, including appointments to the Supreme Court, cabinet members, and other positions to run the individual agencies in the executive branch, and ambassadors to foreign countries. The Senate also has the sole power to approve treaties negotiated by the President. Without a two-thirds approval by the voting members of the Senate, treaties are rejected and not binding under the law. For example, the Treaty of Versailles that ended the First World War was not ratified by the Senate, and as a result, the United States failed to join the League of Nations. Finally, the Senate has the sole authority to conduct impeachment trials and act as the jury in determining the guilt or innocence of those being impeached. These powers exist because the country is a republic of independent states with their own authority and power that they exercise outside that of the federal government. So, in effect, it is the states that approve federal judges, it is the states that ratify treaties, it is the states that approve the cabinet leaders and the heads of other agencies in the executive branch. The U.S. Senate was the tether that kept the federal government grounded and in some way accountable to the will of the states. That tether, that umbilical that gave the states some oversight power over the federal government, was irrevocably severed with the passage of the 17th Amendment to the Constitution, which provided for the direct election of senators by the people. The ratification of the 17th Amendment in 1913, which established the direct election of U.S. senators by popular vote, marked a watershed moment in American political history. The transformation of the Senate from a body elected by state legislatures to one elected by the populace significantly altered the nature of American federalism and the balance of power between state and federal governments. Again, the original design of the U.S. Constitution, as articulated in Article 1, Section 3, granted state legislatures the authority to elect senators. The framers intended to provide a check on the influence of populist states and preserve the sovereignty of state governments within the federal structure. However, by the mid-19th century, the system faced increasing scrutiny. The rise of Jacksonian democracy and the expansion of suffrage contributed to growing popular demand for more direct control over government institutions. Reformers argued that legislative selection of senators was undemocratic and susceptible to corruption, deadlock, and manipulation by special interests. Throughout the latter half of the 19th century, public support for reform grew, fueled by specific incidents such as the protracted deadlocks in state legislatures and allegations of bribery in Senate elections. The Populist Party, which emerged in the 1890s, strongly advocated for the direct election of senators as part of a broader platform that included monetary reform, government control of railroads, and the initiative and referendum. They viewed Senate reform as essential to wresting power from entrenched elites and enhancing democratic participation. Progressive reformers, such as William Jennings Bryan and Robert La Follette, championed similar reforms in the early 20th century. Bryant, a three-time presidential candidate, consistently pushed for Senate reform, arguing that it would reduce corruption and increase accountability. La Follette, a U.S. senator from Wisconsin, implemented a form of direct primaries in his home state, laying the groundwork for national reform. Muckraking journalists like David Graham Phillips played a pivotal role in shaping public opinion. Phillips's influential article, The Treason of the Senate, published in Cosmopolitan magazine in 1906, alleged that senators were beholden to powerful corporate interests rather than the people. In his article, Phillips focused particularly on prominent senators such as Nelson Aldrich of Rhode Island, whom he accused of acting as an agent for Standard Oil and other monopolistic interests. Phillips contended that many senators were selected not for their public service or qualifications, but because of their loyalty to powerful business entities that funded their campaigns and manipulated state legislatures. He wrote that the Senate had become a pit of graft, unresponsive to the will of the people and entrenched in protecting economic elites. The article portrayed the Senate as the most powerful and autocratic branch of government and suggested that reform could only come through direct public involvement in the electoral process. Phillips's exposé galvanized progressive reformers and outraged the public, significantly raising the political stakes for maintaining the status quo. Organizations such as the National Municipal League and the American Bar Association also supported reform, providing legal and institutional backing to the cause. Their efforts helped lend intellectual legitimacy and coordination to what had previously been a populist impulse. In Congress, reform faced substantial resistance, particularly from senators who had a vested interest in maintaining the status quo. However, persistent public pressure and shifting political tides began to make reform inevitable. By 1911, momentum had grown significantly, leading to the proposal of a constitutional amendment. One of the key congressional figures was Senator Joseph Bristow of Kansas, who introduced the amendment that would eventually become the 17th Amendment. Support from President William Howard Taft, who endorsed the principle of direct election, helped build broader bipartisan backing. State-level movements and legislative resolutions also laid important groundwork. By 1912, 29 states had implemented some form of direct primaries or non-binding popular votes to influence the selection of senators. This made federal reform seem less radical and more a codification of existing practices. The 17th Amendment was passed by Congress on May 13, 1912, and ratified by the required number of states on April 8, 1913. Its adoption reflected a confluence of popular demand, progressive leadership, journalistic exposure, and political pragmatism. But a century later, the question must be asked: was its passage a step in the wrong direction? Proponents contend it democratized the Senate and reduced corruption. Remember, muckraker David Graham Phillips was one that led the charge for reform, and ending the influence of special interests was one of the arguments to convince the public of the need for that change. But no one today can, with a straight face, claim that the Senate is no longer beholden to special interests or corporate money. The only special interests that were silenced were the very ones that the founders intended the Senate to speak for, the state legislatures. The direct election of senators fundamentally altered the structure of American federalism. By removing state legislatures from the Senate selection process, the 17th Amendment weakened state government's direct influence on federal policymaking. This led to an erosion of state sovereignty and centralization of power in Washington. The other result of this change is how it has now shifted the debate about the makeup of the Senate itself. If House seats are apportioned by the population, the debate goes, then shouldn't the Senate be the same? After all, if we are going to toss the original intent of the Senate's role into the dustbin of history, then the Senate is just another representation of the people, albeit with some extra duties. Therefore, shouldn't the number of each state's seats also be based on population? Otherwise, the argument goes, why should Wyoming have as much influence as California? The roots of this new debate stem from recent presidential elections, and more specifically, the role of the Electoral College. There have been 5 presidential elections where the candidate that carried the popular vote did not win the overall election. Those winners of the popular vote who failed to win the presidency are Andrew Jackson in 1824, Samuel Tilden in 1876, Grover Cleveland in 1888, Al Gore in 2000, and Hillary Clinton in 2016. The fact that the last two occurrences also stung the same political party, the Democrats, provided momentum for this renewed debate. Had one of the two recent events been reversed so that the Republican won the popular vote, but the Democrat won the Electoral College vote, it is doubtful that either party would have felt the need to eliminate the Electoral College. That this debate has garnered any support with the public only shows how little understanding there is about the traditional constitutional role of the Senate in the first place. The fact that opponents of the idea of changing the Senate makeup cannot point this out is just as damning. It would be uplifting to hear someone, when asked why Wyoming has the same representation as California, respond with, "Because the Senate represents the state governments and both California and Wyoming only have one." Even hearing, "Because the Senate was supposed to protect smaller states from the mob rule of the larger ones," something historically true, would be refreshing. After all, it's not like there is any debate over the intent of the founders in this matter. The Federalist Papers, the essays written by Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay to sway public opinion towards support for the Constitution's ratification, contain their arguments on the issue. Hamilton, in Federalist No. 27, supports the mechanism of state legislatures selecting U.S. senators by suggesting that it anchors federal institutions in state authority, thereby promoting loyalty to both governments. In Federalist No. 62, Madison explains that the Senate, unlike the House of Representatives, is designed to provide stability and safeguard against transient impulses in public opinion. By granting each state equal representation, 2 senators regardless of population, the Constitution balances the influence of both large and small states. Madison writes, "The equality of representation in the Senate is another point, which must have been attended with equal difficulty in the convention, but was probably attended with greater." In Federalist No. 62 and No. 63, Madison argues that the Senate is a check not only on the House, but also on the federal government itself, ensuring that state governments are not rendered obsolete or powerless. In Federalist No. 64, John Jay argues that the Senate's advice and consent role in treaties ensures that the states have a say in international agreements that could affect their interests. All of that was erased by the ratification of the 17th Amendment. The U.S. Senate in its current form is unlikely to change anytime soon, regardless of the debate. Changing the size of each state's delegations would require a constitutional amendment. Even if it could pass the required two-thirds vote threshold in both houses of Congress, it would also have to be ratified by three-fourths of the state legislatures, which means 38 states would have to approve. It is hard to imagine enough smaller states like Wyoming, Alaska, Idaho, and others deciding to commit political suicide by relinquishing what little power they have remaining at the federal level. On the other hand, there is no movement in the other direction, pushing for the repeal of the 17th Amendment and a return to the Constitution as intended. Even if there was, convincing enough people to get on board or finding the votes necessary seems insurmountable. That dream is little more than the futile ramblings of obscure podcasters and a segment of historians who see the genius in the original design set by the Constitution. And for the record, I freely admit that this is my own personal crusade. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast. Show notes, including a list of references, can be found at the blog at rootsoftoday.blog. Due to the president's decision to bomb Iranian nuclear sites and the questions surrounding presidential authority, the next episode will deal with the power of the president to commit troops and wage war. The number of military interventions ordered by past presidents may shock you. Tune in next week for the details.